Welcome to the Financial Management Magazine podcast series, a service of the Association of International Certified Professional Accountants. This series features discussions with chartered global management accountants and other experts about the topics, trends and technologies that are transforming the accounting profession.
This is Neil Amato, a senior editor with FM Magazine. I recently had the chance to hear a presentation from Nandu Nankishore. He was gracious enough to then take time for a short interview. In this podcast, normally, this would be the spot where I'd briefly introduce the speaker. But we're going to change things up and let Nandu introduce himself. So, Nandu, take it away.
Okay, my name is Nandu Nankishore. I retired recently from Nestle, where my last position was as the executive board member heading Asia, Africa, and Oceania. I now am on the board of a few companies. I mentor several startups around the world, and I teach at various schools. I'm an executive fellow at London Business School, and I consult.
Thank you for taking time to talk. Let's hit on a few trends affecting global business today and what the term VUCA has to do with that. VUCA standing for volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity.
The term VUCA, I believe, was invented by the American military in the 90s and increasingly is now very applicable to business because we see a lot of disruption and uncertainty. In many ways, the volatility has decreased after the 2008 Lehman Brothers-driven crisis. But the uncertainty index now is even higher. There are many sources for this uncertainty, and technology is one huge part of the disruption that is being driven across businesses. Some of the biggest stock market valuations today, whether it's Google or Facebook, did not exist 15 years ago. So this is a new world we are living, a world of ideas where there are disruptive ideas that are going to create new business models. And the next Uber and the next Facebook is probably not even in existence today, but it's going to come. So it's an exciting time to do business. It's a scary time to do business. We know that the average life of a Fortune 500 company in the 1920s was about 90 years, and now it's down to 15. And a lot of this has to do with the VUCA environment we live in. Luckily, there are some underlying trends that do give us some certainty, provided we identify them and prepare our businesses for them. So those we can definitely do. And at the same time, we need to develop the capabilities to deal with the uncertainty that arises from technology and other factors. So what are these underlying trends? The first is the emerging economic dynamic where, as the economist says, the global center of gravity of the global economy is shifting from the mid-Atlantic back to Central Asia, which is where it was 200 years ago. And it seems to be headed right back where it was. With the development and the economic growth across all emerging markets, but particularly China and India. The decade 2010 to 2020 is the decade where a few significant things happened. The first is, for the first time after a 150-year hiatus, emerging markets were once again 50% of global GDP in 2010. For the first time after a hiatus of 150 years, in 2010 also, south-south capital flows were greater than north-south capital flows. The projected top 10 economies in the year 2050 now have something like 6 or 7 economies out of the top 10, which were not in the top 10 in the year 2000. So there's a big fundamental underlying economic shift underway. We know that, and it's happening now. Other things happening now, which we know for certainty, is a changing demographic. Birth rates are dropping, and societies are getting older in general across the world. Almost the only parts of the world that still have birth rates that are higher than replacement levels is areas which have significant poverty, places like Africa, and where there is not the same level of female emancipation as there is in the other economies.
You said recently that Africa is the economy that most of us underestimate. Why is that, and what does a, quote, lack of baggage have to do with optimism surrounding Africa for the future?
There is a significant change underfoot in Africa, and I'll talk about it on three levels. One is demographics, second is political, and the third is in skills. And at the demographic level, Africa is almost the only part of the world, including parts of the Middle East, that still have birth rates that are higher than replacement levels, and therefore have a significant demographic dividend of working age population well into the second half of this century. So I read somewhere that by the end of this century, one in every four human beings will be African. And that's quite a leap. Today, Africa has 1 billion people in a global population of 7 billion. So it's much less than one in four. It's going to double as a percentage. So there's growth, there's opportunity. But that opportunity will not lead to economic growth if there is no governance, if there are no governance and political governance models to harness that working age population. And here again, we start to see in Africa, governance structures are evolving, they're improving. I was very heartened to see the very smooth and peaceful transition of power in Nigeria. Rwanda, after the crisis of the genocides, is today apparently one of the best governed and least corrupt economies in Africa. There are economic blocks, zones like the East African Community, which start to become a reality and start to function, far from satisfactory the way they're functioning, but they start to function in a direction that's very, very promising. So there's many good things happening on the political and governance side to support the demographics. On the skill side, and here's where I'm really impressed when I travel in Africa and I meet some of the young people there. You know, these people are world class. So there's some very skilled manpower available in Africa, and we don't realize how much there is. So, and not only is there skill, these are people who have no baggage in legacy systems. So they are early adopters of new technology. Kenya already has the highest percentage of GDP done through mobile and e-commerce, 25%. They invented mobile payments, and it's transformed the economic inclusion in the country. So there's a lot of good things happening which give reason to be optimistic about Africa as one of the emerging economies through the century.
Okay, let's shift continents. You've traveled to many places, one of them being the country of Japan. What are the trends there in terms of demographics, and how are they affecting that society right now and moving forward?
Yeah, Japan is a very developed society and one that is aging very rapidly. I believe something like 25% of Japan is above the age of 65. The population of Japan today is, at the turn of the century, was about 120 million and is forecast to decline by a million people every year through to the year 2050. Now, and this is, you know, in human society, we've always lived in populations that are growing. And for the first time here in Africa, in Japan, you have a population that's actually going to shrink and is shrinking now. And that puts a lot of strain on economic growth for the Japanese government on the one hand, but it also puts strain on the social models and the economic models that can actually support aging. Apparently, one of the biggest problems old people have in Japan is sarcopenia, which is a loss of muscle mass. Apparently, the reason this happens is because of lack of nutrition. And again, when you ask why, it seems that the lack of nutrition is linked to one physiological reason, which is declining efficacy of taste buds to taste food. But second, more important, is a social reason, which is old people are lonely. They feel unwanted, they feel unvalued, and they don't have company. And eating seems to be a social behavior, so they just eat less. So it's a pointer. Japan is a pointer to some of the challenges that other societies are going to have to grapple with very soon, as baby boomers retire now. And quite as a contra, Africa has a growing population and a booming demographic dividend that's still going to play out over the next few decades.
Americans tend to think the baby boom generally just applies to the post-World War II increase in births in the U.S., but the baby boom has had a global effect. It has been a global event, correct?
Well, it's the baby boom years, you're right, the baby boomers is used to refer to the U.S., but you had the baby boom in Europe after the Second World War for precisely the same reason. And you had the baby boom happening across most of Asia at the time because they just became independent from colonialism and they started to invest in their own future. And you had a baby boom. So the baby boom was actually quite global at that point of time. And all those baby boomers are retiring about now in this decade. I was part of the first generation to be born in India after independence. And I'm retiring now. So this is going to lead to a few interesting challenges for global societies, not just American. The first thing is, as baby boomers retire, they are going to put a burden on the pension system as a whole. And there are well-funded pensions and less well-funded pensions. And this is an issue that governments and societies are going to have to deal with. The second thing is, as baby boomers retire, they will leave a gap in the work environment, in the skill set, because they take with them years, decades of experience and wisdom. So companies and societies are going to have to replace that with younger people. And I'm not quite sure that you have the numbers yet to actually replace that perfectly. Probably a lot of that replacement is going to happen through automation and roboticization, which is happening as we speak. But the opportunity that this raises is that the baby boomers, as they step out of full-time work, they're going to start doing other things. And they're going to create an entirely new market for goods and more than goods for services, including old age care, that don't exist today. So it's a boom business opportunity for those businesses who can identify this opportunity and cater early to it with robust models.
When people discuss emerging markets, that discussion is often about the large countries, the large economies of China and India. But what are some of the changes taking place in other nations, such as, for example, Indonesia?
Yeah. Well, let me broaden the question more than Indonesia to talk about the ASEAN region. The ASEAN region and the ASEAN tigers, you know, what they have achieved in actual mobility of people from below the poverty line into middle class, what they have done, the transformation they've had over the last 50 years is incredible. It's a story no less impressive than the Chinese story. No less impressive, even more than maybe some of the other stories that are out there. And the ASEAN Free Trade Zone, or the ASEAN Economic Community, what they call the ASEAN Free Trade Area, AFTA, which is, the core is Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, Philippines, but then has expanded to include Vietnam, Cambodia, Myanmar, and so on. So, and they have a vision to expand AFTA to include, you know, what they call ASEAN plus six, include markets like China, Japan, India, Korea, Australia. And when that happens, because the direction is quite straight, it is going to happen. When that happens, it will be a common free trade market of 3 billion people. Probably the single most powerful economic engine the world has ever known. And it's in the process of being set up right now. it's not the region is not without its ups and downs, and the entire ASEAN region saw an economic meltdown in 1998 with the huge currency crisis that in Indonesia, the rupiah went from 2,000 rupiah to a dollar, went down to 17,000 rupiah to a dollar in the space of 6 months. And an entire middle class was wiped out. And that was a huge human tragedy caused by depreciating currency, caused in turn by probably speculative investments and mismanagement of currencies and debt. Indeed, as Prime Minister Mahathir of Malaysia at the time believed, it was caused also by currency manipulators. So I don't know what the truth is, but it caused a lot of economic hardship. But the point I'd like to focus on is not the economic hardship, because that happened, but how they bounced back. Because all those economies, without exception, they took the pain. They took two, three years to work through the pain, and then they bounced back. And it's that resilience and ability to deal with crisis that, to my mind, sets apart the ASEAN economic community. And why I'm so optimistic that they will make this ASEAN plus six an economic reality. And that's a huge economic miracle that's going to unfold.
What are the ways businesses need to respond to these changes, and what is the role of trust in that response?
In many ways today, an organization that does not change or is not prepared to go out there and change business models and disrupt business models faster than its competitors can do, those organizations will become dinosaurs. So you have to change. But the thing to be careful about when you drive change in the business model, be very careful before you touch anything that impacts your organizational purpose, your core of who you are, your raison d'etre, your DNA or your values, or anything indeed that impacts trust. One of the most important things any company builds, and this is underrated and even not sufficiently understood and definitely not reported, is the amount of trust that a company builds with its customers, but also with its employees, with its business partners, with governments, with stakeholders. And this trust takes decades to build, and it's very easy to destroy the trust. Just one bad customer experience, which is then amplified on social media, as we saw with United Airlines recently, can undermine decades of work that goes towards building trust. So be very careful that before you touch anything that affects trust or values or purpose or the belongingness that your customers feel or your employees feel for you. Because touching those will fundamentally destroy your sustainability as a company.
Nandu, thanks for joining us.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.